Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Death of Death, where we proclaim Christ's victory over sin, death, and everything else. I'm your host, Nick Stewart. The moment you've all been waiting for has finally arrived. It's finally time for the final part of our three-part series with Trevor Wright. I never had a proper name for this series, so I guess I can retrospectively call it the Life and Trials of Trevor Wright, something like that. That's catchy. This is the first episode I've been able to do with my proper recording equipment. This stuff was in a flight case and a Relo Cube and a truck and all of that halfway across the country, and here it sits before me just like it always has. And that's the amazing world we live in today. We can get anything anywhere we need to. And I bet you guys are all glad that I'm not recording these intros and outros on my iPhone anymore, because it was not the quality that you are accustomed to on this podcast. You are accustomed to the height of luxury when it comes to your listening pleasure. So, sitting at our new kitchen table, this will be the first of many recordings at this table. There's also a bookcase behind me with a lot of cool stuff on it. I'll have to do some video content someday. We've got some, let's see here, we have a bust of John Owen, author of the original Death of Death. We've got an assortment of skulls, even a T-Rex skull, and a lot of Michael Crichton books. So this would be the perfect spot in which to do a video podcast. So, last week, Trevor was telling a story about confronting the leadership in his church. Sin was being covered and excused left and right, and right in the middle of it all, he begins feeling horrible abdominal pain and discovers that he has colon cancer. That's where we left off last week. In this episode, he's going to share the details of his diagnosis and treatment. We do wrap up the story of what was going on at his old church, but we don't revisit the details of it. So if you haven't heard last week's episode, might help to go back and give that a listen. That way you know what we're referring to when we get there. We also get into the theology with which he approached these situations and the things that we all go through on a daily basis, living life under the sun, as he would say. So I'll tell you what. Am I starting to speak with a drawl already? I tell you what. But seriously, I am a blessed man to know Trevor and to be able to count him as a friend. So let's get into it now.
It's in the midst of all of this that I suddenly start having excruciating abdominal pain, which I later found out was not constipation, but a cancerous tumor that had formed within my colon and completely sealed off my colon to the point where nothing was being expelled. And I was about a quarter centimeter from exploding from the inside out when I finally went into the doctor in writhing pain, and they told me I had to have an emergency surgery right away, and they cut me open.
As someone who, you know, was your friend during this time, you know, I can imagine it was a similar feeling hearing this story on the podcast now. You think you know where the story's going, and you think you've got a pretty good idea of story structure and how things generally happen, and then it just doesn't end up the way you think it's going to end up. And so, yeah, if you want to talk about that a little, it was like a 5-day ordeal you went through. I don't know if you want to get into those kind of details, but
like the actual circumstances of the cancer,
basically you thought you were constipated, and it took days to figure out what was actually going on.
Yeah, so it was. I've gotten pretty comfortable with talking about my bowel movements.
Again, you don't have to.
When you get colon cancer, you kind of have to. But yeah, wasn't able to pass anything for 5 days. And the sixth day was Saturday. And that Saturday, I had already, during the week, taken enemas and had laxatives and stool softeners. Nothing was happening. It just kept getting more and more painful, and I wasn't able to sleep at night. I was just writhing pain. I thought I had appendicitis maybe, but I was actually worried, what if I go to the emergency room and I really am just constipated and I just wasted my money? You know, I'm a young married man. We have, you know, a little boy. My wife's pregnant. We don't have a lot of money to spare. I'm the janitor at my crumbling local church. You know, can I really spend $350 right now to go have a tube stuck up my rear end to just be told, like, really, buddy, you came in because you were constipated? And so I was afraid that's what it was going to be. So I didn't go in. And, you know, after, you know, Friday night, it was just excruciating. And I said, okay, I'm going to try this enema that I did not want to try, because you have to actually stick it up the other end. And it was just like, I'll die. I'm good. I don't want to do that one.
I'm totally fine with dying.
Totally cool. You know, with dying. And so I did it and nothing happened. And that's when I was like, all right, well, urgent care is just $100. So I'm going to go to urgent care and see what they can tell me is going on. And so I went to urgent care, and the young doctor there had me lay down. And I said, you know what? It's just really bad abdominal pain. It's the worst at night. You know, I just feel like I'm being torn apart from the inside out. And, you know, we had looked up tons of things on WebMD, and you see cancer and stuff like that, but you also see things like Crohn's disease and all this stuff. And he said he heard movement in all four quadrants of my colon, which meant, you know, it's moving, but it's moving really, really slow. You're probably just very constipated. And, you know, I had read that in times of severe stress, you know, your body can just shut down. And I was just like, that's what's happening. I mean, there were nights during all of this that I would go to bed and my face was literally numb. Like, I could not feel my face because of how stressed I was. Because I thought, you know, you go into these meetings with these elders, trying to get them to see what's taking place is so wrong, that these men need to be pulled out of their office. And you feel like your ability to argue that is what's going to bring justice to these, you know, young women, my wife being one of them that's come forward with this story. And that weight kind of rests on you, and you go through the conversations in your head. How can I help them see this better? How can I make the case better for these girls? And so it's just, it drives you nuts. And I thought, yeah, I'm probably just really constipated. This guy said, yep, you're really constipated. What you need to do is you need to go to the local Target and get the biggest bottle of Miralax that you can find. It's going to tell you one serving is just one little cup. He said, I want you to find the biggest bottle of Gatorade that you can find, and I want you to pour that entire bottle of Miralax into that Gatorade and just chug it. Just chug it. And I was like, yeah, like, let's get this. Yeah, you know, yeah. I'm cool with that. It is the most disgusting. It's like, ugh, it's like probably what the green milk from Star Wars, like, would actually like be like. Like, it has that consistency to it. It's so weird drinking Gatorade that has a milky like whole milk, whole fat consistency to it. Like, it is gelatinous. And so I drank that, and that Saturday night is when the pain was the worst. And that's when I finally told Cheryl. I was like, I'm so sorry, sweetie. We have to call my mom. I have to go to the doctor right now. I don't know what's going on. I feel like I'm gonna explode from the inside. Little did I know. that's exactly what was taking place. So I go in to the emergency room. They don't take me back right away. I'm like in my chair, like writhing in pain, like twisting and turning. And all that's going through my head is like, I'm going to die at any moment right now. I'm going to die. Like, and I'm going to die in the emergency room waiting room. And they finally, called me back. They did an X-ray of my stomach, and they said, they gave me a soap water laxative, which is where they, you know, dehumanize you, hang a bucket of warm soap water above your hospital bed, and then have a 19-year-old nurse in training come in and say, do you want to do this? Or should, or like, no joke, she asked me if I wanted to do this to myself. And I was just like, I seriously said to her, I was like, I tried to do an enema earlier today and I couldn't even get that up there. Like, yeah. She was like, okay. Like, and I,
all right,
and
I'll,
I could, I actually have seen on like nursing boards, like afterwards, like how much they hate people that come in who are just constipated. It's like, really, dude, stay at home.
Yeah.
And I kind of got that vibe from the nurse, like, and so she stuck the soap water up there and left the room. This is a weird moment for anybody to come in.
Yeah, you walked. Troy walked in the middle of enemas. Yeah. And we could bring it around. Yeah. Basically.
Yeah, colon cancer story.
Fun.
You can break in any. This is a communal conversation. Yeah, it's guys. Fine. You're good. If anybody has any other fun stories, just chime in. So she does it once, leaves the room, and it's basically like you hold that in there until you absolutely can't anymore, sort of a thing, and usually takes care of stuff right away. Mm-hmm. It didn't. Basically, all that came out of me was what was put into me. Yeah. It's just, it was flavored with what was ever at the very bottom of my inner tubes. Mm-hmm. And she did it two more times, left the room, and again, only what was put into me came out. Only the third time, it's by the grace of God, I threw up. It was so painful and everything. I threw up, and she said, "What did you throw up?" And I said, earlier today at noon, now it's like midnight, I was told to drink a bunch of Gatorade, and she said, I need to go get the doctor.
Yeah.
And that's,
you're throwing things up that you drank 12 hours ago.
Yeah. And so that's when I mean, I knew the whole time this wasn't, at this point.
Yeah,
I knew
you have to convince doctors, which is the most messed up part.
Yeah. And before the enema was given to me, I was told that the x-ray found no abnormal, you know, amount of, you know, stool buildup or anything like that. So they were just looking for a backload of stool, which I did not really, you know, have, because it was just a tumor that was stuck right there. And when I threw up, that was kind of the warning sign for that nurse. And she, by the grace of God, went and got a doctor. They shot me up with morphine. And I was still in pain. Like, it was bad. And it's all kind of a blur at that point, but they had to put me under for an emergency colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. I woke up from that colonoscopy with my wife and my mom crying at the bedside next to me, because they had already been told and shown images that there was a tumor that was completely, it grew like a donut. And so in your colon, it's a tube, right? It grew from the outside in. So I had been having symptoms of like different bowel movements, but nothing ever completely stopped. And it was because it was growing like a donut until that hole got smaller and smaller and smaller and then closed off.
So it was like growing on the walls and closing in.
Yeah, exactly. And so they had to call on a surgeon. And I mean, I've had the surgery afterwards to reverse what was done in that first emergency surgery. And when you go into a surgery, they have you sanitizing yourself the night before with special soap. They have you do enemas where everything is completely cleared out, because the chance of bacterial infection and everything is just so crazy. I mean, it is a miracle that I didn't die during this emergency surgery, because I hadn't used the bathroom in 5 days. There was, you know, matter in those tubes, and they had to cut me open from my belly button down to my pelvis and remove that section of my colon where the tumor was, and reroute my colon out the side of my stomach to the left of my belly button, which they cut through. And that, I really liked my belly button, but anyway, colon out the side of my stomach. It's called an ostomy, where you have a bag that you don't control. You're basically like a bird. And when you eat, you know, you don't decide where you crap anymore. It just happens. And that's always fun at the dinner table.
You taught me that that's called a stoma.
Where the your colon actually pokes out. That's the stoma.
Yeah.
The ostomy is the bag that it goes into. Yeah, and when somebody usually says they're you know, pooping outside, there's somebody says, I have an ostomy. Yeah. But it, yeah, that's the stoma, that where you can actually see your inner. It's a weird thing having your gut, your part of your intestine, large, small or large. I always get mixed up. I think it's large, sticking out the side of your body. It's just
I can imagine.
Just weird having it's everything weird. Happening on the front instead of the front and the back, you know?
Weird having parts of your insides on your outside, as Brian Regan would.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, I wake up from the colonoscopy. They tell me there's the option of an epidural, to which I say, I think this is as close as I'm going to get to the full pregnancy experience. So let's do this thing. And so they gave me an epidural. They cut me open, took the section out, and I wake up in the hospital. And, you know, you're immobilized, had a catheter. You know, I was in the hospital, I think, for a total of 7 or 8 days. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it was really weird. But it was also, oddly enough, like, I was just like, so this is how you saved me from that church.
Yeah, because you didn't go back, did you?
No, I did not. Yeah. In the hospital for about 8 days, it was a weird experience. It's weird because I didn't know it was coming. I think a lot of people have more of a meaningful experience on their hospital beds when they know that a big operation is coming and all that. My instinct was, I want to be as okay as possible, because when you wake up from, I was just in excruciating pain. I wanted the pain to go away when I first went in. Mm-hmm. And so that's all that was filling my mind at the time, was I was in so much pain. I was, you know, throwing up and, you know, and everything. So I didn't have much time to really contemplate, like, I wonder what the grand scheme is and all of this or anything like that. And then you wake up and you see your wife, you know, who you already have a child with, who's pregnant, you know, weeping at your hospital bedside, along with your mom crying. And I just grabbed her hand and I said, we're okay. We're going to be like, this is okay. Like, we know who's in control of all of this. And we know what this life is and what everything entailed. Like, we're okay. We're going to be okay. I wanted her to be okay. And I was on enough morphine at the time that I was okay.
Now you get it.
And so on that hospital bed, like, I just wanted her to be okay. I wanted my friends to be okay. I wasn't really processing anything that I was going through, except for the fact that I knew this hospital bed doesn't come to a whole lot of people. And this moment in my life might be an opportunity to say something to the people that don't believe in my life without even having to say something to them, where they could see me go through this situation believing in Jesus and it be done in a way that makes them kind of wonder, you know, have them ask the question, you know, where does your hope come from, sort of a thing. Deal with a near-death experience in a way that might catch their eye a little bit and bring some glory to Jesus. And so I saw myself as being on mission on that hospital bed, and tried to deal with it as best I could to bring glory to Jesus. That's what I tried to do there. And, you know, there's different books and things that I thought about, but the thing that I kept telling people again and again was that it would be really easy for me in this situation, with what had taken place with our church and what's now taking place with my health, while my wife is pregnant, we have a baby, we have a 1.5-year-old at the time, it'd be really easy for me to ask, where's God? And what's interesting is that that's exactly what the disciples asked Jesus when they were in the boat and they thought that their lives were going to perish. He was asleep and basically asked him, they did ask him the question, do you not care that we're perishing? And it would have been really easy for me to ask God, like, do you not, like, is this just, you don't care? Did I do some, you think in those moments, like, did I do something in my past that made you angry enough at me to bring this upon me and my family? And I'm thankful that there's situations like that in the Bible where the disciples ask that question that I'm asking. And Jesus quiets the waves and says, you know, why are you fearful? And it was just a week or two before this that the pastor at the church that I now attend, that you also attend, preached a sermon on that text and quoted Sinclair Ferguson, who pointed out that it was kind of ironic that they asked the question, do you not care that we're perishing? Because the whole reason why he was in that boat, nay, even in the world to begin with, was because he cared that we were perishing. And he would ultimately be the one to perish in a way that we never could have, so that we wouldn't have to actually bear the full brunt of perishing. And so that was kind of what I held on to in that hospital bed, was not only does he care that I'm perishing, he stepped into that with me, and he went through it in a way that I couldn't have, and he's with me, and that's going to be what my message is at this point, and it's what's going to get me through. And so that's where I was on that hospital bed until I went home pooping out the side of my body. And oh man, the worst thing about all of it was the wound changes. So when they had to come in and change the dressings on the cut that went from the top of my belly down to my pelvic bone, the it's amazing what they now do to help heal wounds like that. Before, it was just, you know, you had bandages that were shoved into that crevice and then they tape over it and they have to come in and change that. And they're soaking with, you know, bodily fluid and blood and all that. But now it's really amazing. They put a sponge down into that, and then they put like cellophane basically like over your stomach, and they attach a vacuum and it pumps all of the air out until it seals it shut. And the walls on either side of that wound press in against that sponge really tightly. And it's holding that sponge there to the point where your cell walls start attaching to that sponge. And when they, what sucks is when the bandages would be taken out, the cell walls would be attached a little bit. When the sponge is there, they're attached a lot of bit. And so when they take that sponge out, it's ripping all of that off. And there's no amount of pain medication. I was on Dilaudid, I was on morphine, all of that. When that wound is actually being changed, there's nothing apart from you being knocked out that you're not, you're feeling that. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that ripping of the cell walls is actually what causes your body to say, we need to grow back even faster. Mm-hmm. And it causes the wound to heal even faster. But man, those wound changes were the worst thing. I actually, while it was happening, the only thing that helped me get through it was singing Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing while they were doing the wound change. And my mom and wife, everybody had to leave the room because it was just awful. Mm. But that was the worst of it, for sure. I hated that. I was like, just knock me out. Just put me asleep.
So you were kind of confronted with the same, at least, option of skepticism that you dealt with earlier in life.
What's the point of this, sort of?
Yeah. And the burning squirrel. And you had the sort of faculty to say, no, I choose something better, and I choose something more true.
Yeah. And to lean on. You know, honestly, it was coming to have a robust theology of the fall that helped me through all of that, because it let me know that this world and the things that happen in it are a lot more complex than good things and bad things, and, you know, God either causing a good thing or a bad thing. You know, you can have a view of the fall where we did what was wrong and God's just punishing everybody now. Or you could have a view of the fall that we separated ourselves from God, and it isn't just that separation has caused there to be enmity between us and God when we don't want to be around him anymore, but the very nature of that separation causes for certain things not to be there anymore, such as, you know, painlessness. And so it was actually prior to all of this, I spent half a year preaching through the book of Ecclesiastes. And it was preaching through the book of Ecclesiastes that I actually think set me up for going through all of this in a way that didn't destroy my faith, because I understood that there were more crooked things under the sun than I could ever count. And that was a theology of the fall, that Ecclesiastes pretty much gives us the existential ramifications of being separated from God. You get the judicial ramifications in the fall in Genesis and in Romans, but the existential experience of being in a world that is in a state of not being what it once was in relation to its creator. You know, that's my reading of Ecclesiastes, is, you know, that, you know, it's all vanity, it's all wind, it's all perishing, and there's nothing that's in this world, even the good things, that are worth being held onto in comparison with the good things that are going to be brought about when everything culminates in the full glory and beauty of Jesus. And so not only are the evils of this world not being worth comparison with the good things that are to come, even the best of things aren't worthy of comparison with what's to come. And so to lose either of those things is nothing if you end up gaining Christ. That's the theology of the Christian faith in relation to hard things that happen. So yeah, I think that's what kind of helped me through.
Yeah. So you had a few months there of recovering from your initial surgery, knowing there was another surgery to come. Mm-hmm. They did leave a margin of tumor in the initial surgery, and so they were expecting to find a lot when they opened you up again to basically clean the rest out, right?
Well, the second surgery wouldn't have even taken place if I had shown any signs of any more cancer. So the cancer that I was diagnosed with was stage 3B colon cancer. What had taken place with my cancer is they had taken out the tumor, but it had positive margins, which means what they took out was all cancer. What they like is they take out the tumor, they take out a little bit around that tumor, hoping that there's some line of divide between non-cancerous flesh and cancerous. Problem is that everything was cancer. I had positive margins. So either they cut me open and cut right on that line and there was no more cancer left, or more likely there was some cancer left. And what else they found was they took out 22 of my lymph nodes, 6 of which did test positive for cancer. At that point, the cancer becomes systemic because your lymph fluid is pumped all throughout your body. And so it would stand to reason that being present now in 6 of the 22 lymph nodes, that this cancer could now be systemic and traveling around my body and transporting itself to other organs. So that's what we were left with. Month after the initial surgery, I got blood work done to check for tumor cells. Really cool thing. Cancer eats up more sugar. Is like the monster from MIB, basically, like sugar, more. And the way that a PT scan works is they give you radioactive glucose so that when they do the scan, wherever that sugar is lights up, and they know where that sugar should normally be getting transported. If they see a bright dot in your scan dead center in the middle of your liver, that's not supposed to be happening, and that would be indicative of there being cancerous cells there that are absorbing and hoarding all of that glucose in order to grow and thrive and destroy your body. When I got my PT scan, there was absolutely nothing found, and when the blood work came back, it was usually have a, you know, cancer marker of 5% or less. At 5%, it's like if somebody smokes regularly, they would see something like 5%. Mine was less than 0.5%. So I was like, normal would be like 2%. Yeah. And I was even below that. So, wow. So after a month and a half, there was absolutely nothing there. They wanted me to go on to chemo. And I, through research of my own and just through kind of a gut decision, decided that instead of doing that, I'm young, there's no cancer that's being found in my body at this point, I'm going to change some things. I was under an extremely stressful situation with my church, and I need to actually deal with what's going on inside of my body with all that stress, and I'm going to change my lifestyle and my eating habits. And so, much to the chagrin of your meat-eating friends who listen to this podcast, I went completely plant-based. I was drinking 64 ounces of fresh-squeezed juice every single day. And yeah, tried to get into a better spiritual headspace where I wasn't bearing all the weight of what was going on and kind of let go and let God.
How dare you?
Yeah.
So they eventually did do a second surgery mm-hmm. when they reversed basically the colostomy bag, right?
Yeah. So so May 27th, 2018 is when I had the emergency surgery. It was a Sunday. And then in December, I think on the 16th is when I had the reversal of the surgery. If you're wanting to know some other timeline statistics, in October, that senior pastor was back preaching a sermon at his church.
That's good. That's how that's supposed to go.
After a committee was formed who yeah. never, outside of one or two of them talking to my wife, never actually spoke with the people that actually brought any of the charges forward. So the evidence that was given to them, to this day, people on that committee that decided whether or not that pastor should be put back in, if they listen to this podcast, they know more than they knew at the time when they made that decision. So if you're listening, you might want to rethink your decision. I hope you do.
So, I mean, through that situation where justice in the short term does not seem to have been served, we all know what the long term ramifications of sin is. Through that and your health struggles, which you are now cancer free today.
Cancer free, surgery's been reversed.
Yeah. So there were some.
I got my GED while being out of work. Really? So yeah, real that's awesome. real heartstring story going on right. here. So
after and now you've got a way better job.
And I got a way better job
working with my sister.
Yeah, an interesting thing, more of an emotionally stable place at a local university than at a local church. Mm. Less of a toxic place than a local church, which is pretty sad to say.
Yeah.
Well, because it's not a Christian university.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say is, you know, these were all hard things that you went through and you are cancer free, which is an amazing thing. And short-term justice was not served in the church situation, which is a not so amazing thing, but it is great that in both of these very hard situations and in every hard situation you've ever gone through, God is still sovereign, God is still good, and he has equipped you to, like you said, with a robust theology to not waver on those things. I mean, even if just for a moment, but you know, so
even though justice didn't take place with
even though not all of the situations had perfect results, there still was someone perfect and in charge.
Yeah, and I think, you know, within this world sometimes all the loose ends do get tied together, and you know, things happen the way that they should. But I think if you read your Bible right, this world isn't where that happens all the time. And you should be in the choir of psalmists and with the writer of Ecclesiastes asking the kind of question, why do the wicked prosper? Why is it that the righteous perish in the day and the wicked go on living and seemingly have no consequences for their actions? Sometimes they do. And that's why it's wisdom literature. They're talking about general, you know, realities. There's times where the righteous do prosper. There's times where the wicked really do get what's coming to them in this world. But the promise that we have is that this world isn't the end all be all, and that there's someone in charge that cares more about those things being brought to right than you ever could. I won't say that I've gone through this without my faith being shaken. It's been more shaken in all this than any other situation in my entire life.
For sure.
Not actually mostly because of the cancer. It's how could the Holy Spirit be present in these people? How could this happen within God's church? You start to wonder if the hermeneutic of disbelief makes more sense out of the loose ends than the hermeneutic of belief, the hermeneutic that the interpretation that God's actually in control of all this, or the interpretation that this really is all just chaos. Which one better does justice? And at times the chaos one, you know, brings it about. The thing is that chaos is a part of that God option as well. And a lot of Christians don't allow that into their theology, and there's space for it, at least from our experience of things. There's space for it. This might not be worth mentioning, but not only is the senior pastor back, you know, and he's teaching regularly and all of that, one of the sitting elders who's been brought into the eldership at that church after I left, I actually served with him in the youth group, actually spoke with one of the guys that I now go to church with and said that all the cancer and stuff that happened to me was actually because I went after the pastors of the church and God was judging me.
You came against the Lord's anointed.
Yes.
I was going to mention that too, but everything was going so happy.
So you could splice this back in.
I think that's worth mentioning. I think that would go to show
people that are still being brought into power there.
But that would go to show the mental process by which you would justify the things that were taking place there.
Having never been in the room for any of those conversations and not knowing all the details, that you would land so hard on you got cancer because...
Yeah.
To which I would say, what would you have done if four different women came forward to you and you knew for sure that at least one of those situations took place out of the mouth of that pastor? So anyway.
You would have gotten cancer too, is the moral of that story.
What's interesting is what happens now when one of the pastors there gets cancer.
which is what I was going to say. Like, that opens such a theological can of worms that they would not subscribe to in any other context. They would never say that you get sick because you did something wrong.
Yeah.
But the situation
made the circumstances were so clear, Nick.
These circumstances made it make sense, which goes to show you how tweaked you have to be mentally to accept what they were seeing before their very
eyes. Interesting is I don't know how he reads the book of Job without being thrown in with all of his friends.
You are the last person I'm hanging out with before I leave for Oklahoma.
Sad days, man.
We move the day after tomorrow. Yeah. But
you're going to be missing the warm touch of our overlords.
The space lizards. Well,
they will find you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they're with me. They're in my heart at all times. I'm gonna miss you and gonna miss the church, but you've been a great friend, and it was a strange honor to walk with you through the cancer and the church corruption, and even just to have you here talking about it. So I appreciate you being so candid.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Enjoy your time in Oklahoma, and peace be with you.
And also with you. All right, that's the end of our series with Trevor Wright, but probably not the end of Trevor's appearances on this podcast. I'm formally inviting him back onto the show right now to talk about anything he wants, and this is really just to prove that he listens to my podcast every week. I'll know, Trevor. I'm gonna know if you're listening to me. Alright, that's gonna do it for this week. I've been your host, Nick, here to tell you that cancer and God's wrath aren't always correlated, and if you're as committed to Christ's victory as I am, I'll be here to do it with you all again. Goodbye for now. that's life. This that's all life, of life.
Right? We're doing it live.
We're doing it live. My sister told me you say that at work. Yeah. And I was so happy.
I said, she drove away the moment I pulled up. I was like, she playing this.
Like I was saying, I think you're the reason I bought this. I think I saw how convenient your keys were, yeah, and I wanted to emulate that.
Clip it on, and then people know you're coming. Wards off, yeah, mountain lions at the local grocery store.
Yeah. No, you don't have headphones.
When does the music start?
We don't do that live. I put that in post.
What?